and what could be a remarkable yet potentially fraught treatment for some young people who in the past have been diagnosed as having schizophrenia. It involves treating the immune system and the belief that the problem is that the immune system is attacking the brain, or at least affecting it. And by doing this, a team in Sydney has had some success. In the studio with me are adolescent psychiatrist Dr. Liz Scott of St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, Director of the Brain and Mind Institute at the University of Sydney, Ian Hickey, immunologist and immunopathologist at New South Wales Health Pathology at Westmead Hospital, David Brown, and Kathy McCabe, whose both daughters have been on the treatment program. Welcome to you all. Liz Scott, where did the idea of this come from?
So, Norman, it's been an interesting area of medicine, and it partly came out of seeing a number of cases at St. Vincent's Hospital, and particularly in the private hospital, that were very perplexing, of cases of early onset of psychosis with young people who had very complex disorders, who didn't respond to the usual treatments and really went on to develop a very deteriorating course with very severe syndromes resulting in long periods of hospitalization and a lot of disability.
So just give me a typical story.
So, for instance, they would start out with psychotic symptoms.
That's delusional behaviour.
Yep, delusions, become very paranoid, often atypical symptoms. So we associate auditory hallucinations, hearing voices, but a lot of these young people had quite atypical symptoms. They would see things, they would have visual hallucinations or tactile hallucinations. They would often look as though they're quite confused, almost delirious, and they would have marked trouble with their sleep. So spend long periods of time sleeping, falling asleep in like a narcolepsy type syndrome, or they had periods of time where they wouldn't sleep at all. So, and a change in clinical picture with complicated by a whole lot of systemic problems, often trouble with their heart rate variability, which would see people collapsing at various times, trouble with their gastrointestinal tract, trouble with their, and other trouble related to kind of infections or immune system.
And this is not a new disorder, it's just that your eyes have been open to it.
That's right. So we're assuming that we've seen people like this in the past, but just assume that they've got very severe or treatment-resistant psychosis. But because we're much more aware now of the physical health consequences of these types of diseases and disorders in young people. So we're particularly looking at the metabolic effects and other systemic effects. So we're looking at blood profiles and looking at the whole history and the whole course of illness. We're much more aware of how complex these syndromes are. They're not just mental health syndromes. They affect the whole body.
So David Brown, where did the idea that it might be the immune system come from?
Well, I've been looking after patients with autoimmune disease for a long time, and they've often had psychiatric symptoms. And over time, I wondered whether people with psychiatric symptoms by themselves, which were treatment resistant, might be due at least in part to autoimmune disease.
And when you treated, so give me a sense of the autoimmune, is this rheumatoid arthritis?
Rheumatoid arthritis, Sjogren's syndrome.
That's where you've got dry
lupus,
eyes.
Where you have sore joints and skin rashes. And these people often have significant psychiatric disability, and when you treat them, they get better. You could always say, well, that's just their disease getting better, but I had a sense that it was more than that. And so that led me on to the question of whether they could present primarily as psychiatric disease, and it seems as though they can.
Kathy, tell me the story. You've got two daughters undergoing this treatment. We'll get to what the treatment is in a minute. Tell me their stories.
Elle was very unwell from birth, and it wasn't until she was 16 when she became quite psychotic that someone actually took notice. Dr. Scott, in fact, helped us. And since then...
When you say psychotic, just describe what was going on.
Well, she wasn't at school anymore. She was at home most of the time. She was terrified that everyone was trying to kill her. She was doing lots of unusual things that we didn't understand. We didn't even know what psychosis was ourselves. She was very unwell, and it wasn't until she became that bad that somebody took notice and helped us. And we finally have, since then, it got a bit worse at times, but we've got better.
On the treatment, which we'll come to the treatment in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And how's she going on the treatment?
Pretty good. She's doing quite well. She's at uni now, and she's functioning to the best of her ability. She's not quite normal, can't kind of really push herself too much. But she's quite well compared to what she was. And we're lucky to still have her.
And your younger daughter developed symptoms too.
Yes. Over that adolescent period, she had depression and anxiety. She wasn't at school for over 6 months, had lots of physical symptoms, but she didn't develop a psychosis. But she's improved out of sight since she's had the immune therapy treatment as well.
So, Liz, what happened there? I mean, just take us through how you assess somebody like this and what do you, you know, what conclusions you came to.
So, first of all, it is about, as David says, recognising that there's something more. These are just something
more.
So
what was it about Elle that thought there was more?
So I think partly it was her mother's persistence in saying, look, this is not right. This is not right. But also it is looking for other markers of illness. So we were looking for immune markers. We look at family history. Is there a family history of autoimmunity, which in this case there was? Is there a change in the progression? Is there a difference in the trajectory of these disorders compared to what we would normally see? So we start looking for other kind of biological markers of illness or of brain disturbance.
And what treatment are they on? Is the treatment, you know, do you just sort of put your finger in the air and say, well, we'll try this or what?
No, look, in this particular case, along with all of these symptoms, there were some key signs of immunodeficiency, and that was frequent skin infections. So in this particular case, a diagnosis of immunodeficiency was made, which has a genetic basis. At least in part. And so initially the treatment was directed as you would for somebody with this particular condition, which was intravenous immunoglobulins. And that significantly ameliorated some of the symptoms, but not all. And in a subgroup of these patients with immunodeficiency, you can also surprisingly get autoimmunity. And so when we had tried the least toxic therapies, we started some immunosuppression.
Ian Hickey, we're not alone in Australia doing this.
No. It turns out in just about every major, highly specialised psychiatric service for young people in the world, there's a group of people who are traditionally thought to have autoimmune encephalitis. So an inflammation of the brain based on a reaction of the body attacking itself through production of antibodies against oneself, thought to be, you know, 1 in 10,000. The big issues become, is this 1 in 1,000? Is this 1 in 100? In fact, of the atypical syndromes, might it be as common as 1 in 10 of the atypical sorts of presentations? The ones Liz was describing, very acute courses, look almost confused, agitated. And then when you start to investigate with MRI brain scanning, lumbar punches, EEGs, there's evidence, non-specific evidence of brain change. And then really the clinical decision needing to be made, is something going on? Worldwide, there's a lot of screening for new antibodies, the most important one, anti-NMDA, but also a range of other new antigens or markers that are on the neuron cell surface, from the surface of the nerve cells, or the synaptic proteins, the proteins that are part of the nerve transmission.
And we've had a story on the Health Report in the past about anti-NMDA from this bizarre and rare tumour in the ovary in some young women, which can then affect brain function and be dramatic when you remove it. So how many people have you treated, Liz, and what sort of results?
So I think we have treated probably around 15 people, David, and I have to say that the results have been remarkable in the majority of cases. So, and you have to, these are people who, in a sense, we've run out of traditional treatments and have had a deteriorating course. And they have almost all got back to work or got back to university or returned to study. And their quality of life has dramatically improved and the quality of life of their families have dramatically improved.
But I assume they all have different diagnoses. They don't all have the same autoimmune condition.
No. So these are not the same disorder. They are mixed disorders, but all have, in a sense, the same endpoint in affecting the brain and causing this kind of disturbance in brain systems.
Kathy, your kids have gone through an experiment. Did you know it was an experiment?
Yes, but we didn't have any other choice. We were at the end of the road. Elle was very unwell, and we were going to lose her to suicide or something like that if she didn't get some help.
She was so unwell.
Yeah.
So you'd reached the brick wall at the end of the road.
And all the girls that we see at St. Vincent's, they're amazing, like how much they've improved, like to see how sick they are and then see them now. They're at, you know, TAFE. They're not like all the other kids, I've got to say, but they're doing really well.
It's not a cure, but it's helping a lot.
Yep.
And were you nervous about it, given that it was an experiment and you were going to the unknown?
No, we were desperate to try anything.
Ian Hickey, I mean, there are huge ethical issues here, are there not? This is not a randomised trial. You're just stabbing in the dark.
There are huge issues, and there are huge issues in a number of things. So this is a typical thing that happens in clinical medicine. Something that's thought to be very rare, as you say, the teratoma type example, something that's thought to be 1 in 100,000 type cases, you make an individual clinical decision, but it's never going to become a clinical trial because it's so rare. You make the clinical decision to save the person's life at the time. As you move to thinking, oh, maybe this isn't so rare, you get in the situation. So now what we've proposed across a range of people in these areas, major centres, across immunology, psychiatry, is what protocols do we need to have in place for testing, for decision making, and then for the discussion.
Because it could be open to the cowboys now.
Exactly. The door. So if I suddenly say, look, not 1 in 10,000, but 1 in 10, you can imagine the difference we're into. Then we're into really controversial areas. So the other issue for us here is adequate. See, practitioners can sit around and go, okay, we all agree about a protocol. But the issue that fusses me most is actually involvement of parents and young people themselves in the progressive decision-making. This is not a one-off decision to be in a clinical trial. It's not a one-off decision to have some specific tests. It's a process of weighing up at each point along the way what might be the relative benefit of actually taking this course versus conventional therapy versus what are the significant risks, short and long term, of changing a person's immune profile.
Now, Scott, it's been known for a while that there's something funny about the immune system in general with people with schizophrenia, and that mothers who have, well, rather than reverse it, when you look at people with schizophrenia and then look at their mothers, they have more infections during, they're more likely to have had an infection in the antenatal period. Could this apply more broadly to people with schizophrenia, or is it just in this specific group?
I think, as Ian says, that it is likely that it, what we see are the very kind of rare and severe cases, but there are probably a group of people underneath that who have subthreshold disorders. So this is probably much more broader than we think, and it gives us the opportunity for real, you know, prevention and new interventions. So I think it is a great opportunity, but we have to approach it extremely carefully.
David, do we know the right tests? Do we know the right treatment? Well, I mean, these treatments can be very toxic.
Sure. So, look, I mean, these patients fall into three broad categories. One is that you can make a diagnosis of an immune disease. The other category is that there's clear evidence of inflammation there, which makes it easier to explain why you want to do what the options are and what the side effects could be. The third issue is where there's really no evidence of any immune perturbation, and that's much more difficult to justify. And at this point in time, I think that...
So have you treated anybody that you thought was this condition but you couldn't find any immune abnormalities?
No, I haven't.
Right.
Because I think that it's difficult to justify.
Because the treatment could kill... You know,
correct.
Unlikely, but it could kill the
person. It could kill them. And I think that really we have to approach this methodically and scientifically and have trials to work out what the best tests are and
But all your researchers are doing different things around the world. Are you getting together on this?
Yes.
Norman, that's the big goal. The big goal is not for everyone to do something funny in their own individual centre, and that's the danger at the moment. And a lot of controversy amongst professionals about what is the right person to treat or not. And there is an issue whether some of the standard presentations that actually we would not have thought of as classically having an immune problem actually do have an immune problem. As the tests have become more sophisticated, guess what? We find more evidence from brain scanning and better auto or antibody screening of actually more young people who didn't have atypical disorders who have indicators of this type of problem. But unless we get it together nationally and internationally, we won't know what we're doing.
It can be too wide a spread with too toxic a treatment. Look, thank you all very much indeed. That's fascinating. We'll catch up. And particularly thank you, Kathy, for coming in to tell the story of Elle and Pamela. And the results of this will be further discussed on Friday at the Meeting for Minds conference in Fremantle. And you're listening to Liz Scott, who's an adolescent psychiatrist and runs the Youth Mental Health Services at Vincent's Private Hospital in Sydney. Ian Hickey, who's the director of the Brain and Mind Institute at the University of Sydney. David Brown, who is from New South Wales Health Pathology and Director of Immunopathology at Westmead Hospital, and Kathy McCabe. You're listening to The Health Report here on RN with me, Norman Swan. Still to come, what's the best BMI for survival? Bit of a debate. But let's get to that via the flip side of survival, death. Better Off Dead is a podcast series from the Wheeler Centre in which Andrew Denton investigates the stories, moral arguments and individual experiences and weaves them into discussions about why good people are dying bad deaths in Australia because there's no law to help them.
Kathy Pryor was a nurse in her early 40s in Tasmania, facing the twin calamities of a father dying of cancer and a mother with severe dementia. Her father, Peter, a doctor, had always been upfront about how he wanted to die. One morning, Kathy got a phone call from the private hospital where Peter was in care. He was unconscious and they couldn't rouse him.
Finally, when he did come round and regained consciousness, he admitted what he'd done. He'd taken all his barbiturates. Unfortunately, it didn't kill him. And he was very upset that it didn't kill him.
In his dying weeks, Peter became desperate.
He started talking about trying to either drown himself in the bath or to try and wrap the belt cord round his neck. It was horrible. I went in one day and he said, "I so want to go." And he knew his death was going to be horrible. So I said to him, "Look, Dad, if you really want to go that badly, I'll take you home and I'll help you."
Better Off Dead is available online and will play on RN's Earshot in June.